Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News. My name is Dave Dell. Today, I'll be reading articles from Denverite and Westward. From Denverite, I'll be reading, in D.C., Mayor Mike Johnston has one big ask. Let migrants get to work, by Caitlin Kim. And at Aurora's Stanley Marketplace, recent migrant arrivals are showcasing their skills and making a few dollars along the way, by Isaac Vargas. From Westward, I'll be reading, business developers' wet dream could be residents' worst nightmare, closing the dark horse, by Katie Cheshire. And last weekend's Arctic blast will fuel higher Excel bills, also by Katie Cheshire. I'll finish up the hour with other articles from Westward. These first two articles are from Denverite. In D.C., Mayor Mike Johnston has one big ask. Let migrants get to work, by Caitlin Kim. Wonderfully chaotic. That's how Denver Mayor Mike Johnston described the scene of 300 mayors who gathered in a large Washington, D.C. hotel this week to talk about the issues important to their communities and meet with federal lawmakers and officials. For Johnston, there was one concern foremost on his mind, the migrant crisis and its specific impact on Denver. We have about 5,000 people in shelter on any given night, and we get 200 or 300 a day, every day, that arrive by bus, he said. The city expects to spend $180 million in its 2024 budget on sheltering and assisting migrants. Without federal help, that could mean steep cuts for other city services. Still, the first-term mayor believes the problem is solvable, but only if the federal government steps in. There's a way to do this correctly, Johnston explained, and that would be bring folks in with work authorization, have federal dollars to support them in being integrated successfully, and partner with cities and states to be able to have all of us receive a per capita share of what we can support successfully. He said mayors are used to trying to get stuff done, and that many mayors at the conference were supportive and willing to help advocate. And there's one body in particular that he and others are targeting with their advocacy. We really want to get the focus of the U.S. House of Representatives to say there is bipartisan agreement on this on the ground in all of our cities. We want a system that works for cities and for newcomers, and we think there's a path to do that. That's why, a couple of hours later, Johnston found himself standing outside in the cold in front of the U.S. Capitol. He was there with Senators Michael Bennet and John Hickenlooper, and Representatives Jason Crow and Brittany Petters, all Democrats. The group urged Congress to pass a National Security Supplemental Funding Bill, currently being negotiated in the Senate. That package includes money for border security and FEMA, as well as aid for Ukraine and Israel. But funding is the easiest part of what the group wants to see happen. Johnston stressed the crucial need to allow migrants to gain work permits swiftly and easily. He said he has two types of conversations almost daily in Denver. One with migrants who don't want public charity, just the ability to work, and the other with business owners who have openings that they can't fill. So what we see is people here who want to work, people here who want to hire them, and a federal government who stood in the way of our ability to let those people go to the work for the people that want to hire them, he said. The Biden administration could act unilaterally to grant temporary protected status to more recent migrant arrivals, allowing them to apply for work permits. But for Congress to take up the issue, it would likely have to be part of a broader discussion of the immigration system as a whole. And all efforts along those lines have stalled for decades now. Bennet is also worried that the chaos at the border could fuel anti-immigration feelings among Americans. That would be a terrible outcome, he said. Crow, who represents the most diverse district in the state, believes the immigration system is in desperate need of reform. Congress must act in a common-sense, reasonable way to fix that broken system, and I'm standing here with my colleagues who are working very hard in good faith to do so. Freshman Representative Brittany Pedersen said what the country has in place right now isn't working. We need to fix our asylum process. We need regional pathways for people to apply, and we need quick turnarounds. Sending people off without the ability to work, saying, "We'll see you in 6 years for a court date," is a failed system. But both lawmakers acknowledged the challenges reform faces, especially in an election year, and especially in their Republican-controlled House. Speaker Mike Johnson on Wednesday dismissed any comprehensive immigration changes. "It's a complex issue. I don't think now is the time for comprehensive immigration reform, because we know how complicated that is," he said. The speaker, however, does believe changes to border security are possible. Later in the day, after a meeting at the White House to discuss the security supplemental, Johnson reiterated that any package must include strong border security. "We are insistent that the elements have to be meaningful. The House is ready to act, but the legislation has to solve the problem, and that's the critical point." In 2023, House Republicans passed a border bill, known as H.R. 2, that would tighten asylum standards, require migrants to apply for a stay in Mexico while applying for asylum, and end what's known as catch and release, the practice of releasing migrants caught in the U.S. on their own recognizance while their petition is being heard, rather than holding them in detention. As migrant arrivals have increasingly strained city budgets, Republicans have continued to use the situation to criticize President Joe Biden and Democrats as a whole. "The unrestricted flow of immigrants into Denver is the direct result of failed Democratic policies," GOP Representative Kim Buck posted on the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter. House Republicans are also moving closer to impeaching DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas over the large number of border crossings, even as he's involved in border security negotiations in the Senate. "I think the Republicans are just trying to use this as a political issue, and it's a darn shame because cities like Denver are really suffering, trying to deal with this crisis," said Denver Representative Diana DeGette. Bennett knows better than most that just because the Senate reaches a deal, it will not necessarily blaze a path through the House. He was part of the 2013 group that came up with a bipartisan immigration reform bill that passed with strong bipartisan support in the Senate, only to see the Republican-controlled House fail to take up the bill because of pressure from its right flank. His plea to Speaker Johnson is not to do that this time. "This is one of those cases where we can't just fail, blaming each other, as we often do, walk away and say it's someone else's responsibility," Bennett said. But Speaker Johnson, perhaps even more than Republican speakers before him, has little leverage to overcome a staunchly anti-immigration right flank. Illnesses, retirements, and expulsion have left him with a threadbare majority, and if he angers his caucus too much, a single member can call for a vote to eject him from his position. "We need to be securing the border and removing illegal aliens from our country, not giving illegal aliens work permits and taxpayer-funded lawyers," said Arizona Representative Andy Biggs, a House Freedom Caucus member on X, the site formerly known as Twitter. Despite all these challenges, Denver's Johnston said it hasn't changed his thinking about immigration. Although Denver this week reinstated time limits for migrant families in its shelters, he doesn't think any Coloradan would want migrants to go hungry or freeze. And, he noted, if these newcomers are allowed to work, it could be a net positive for the state. "We think the net positive dramatically outweighs the net negative, but the problem is the current system. If you require the government, city or state or federal, to bear the public costs of supporting people who want to work but can't, that then drives a cost without a benefit," he said. In other words, it's a system that doesn't help anyone. Whether Congress can agree on changes, however, remains to be seen. At Aurora's Stanley Marketplace, recent migrant arrivals are showcasing their skills and making a few dollars along the way. By Isaac Vargas. Bright green, blue, and yellow dog leashes made of recycled climbing rope sat coiled and neatly arranged on a table inside of a Stanley Marketplace storefront. Behind it stood Christian Bolivar, dressed in a graphic t-shirt and a pair of purple wired headphones snaked around his neck. He hoped the icy roads wouldn't keep potential customers away. Bolivar and other vendors, selling everything from arepas to keychains, are recent migrant arrivals who are trying their hands at entrepreneurship thanks to the help of local volunteers who put on Finding Their Way, a fundraiser that is being hosted inside Aurora's Stanley Marketplace every Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. through the month of January. The effort is meant to put to use the skill sets of migrants in need of work. Other services include dance classes, boxing lessons, and even hair braiding. Local volunteer Celia Vanderloop has worked with Bolivar, supporting his efforts to sell dog leashes. Bolivar has a business partner who is also a recent arrival, but asked not to be identified. "We're in the process of setting up an LLC," said Vanderloop. "We're starting to keep better track of what their expenses are, and if this is going to be sustainable, they're going to have to learn how to be salespersons." Shortly after losing her longtime partner in March, Vanderloop has found a new purpose in supporting two Venezuelan migrants in need of a place to stay. Now retired and with two empty rooms, Vanderloop welcomed them into her home. "You retire, and then what's your meaning in life?" Vanderloop said. "This is adding meaning to my life, so they're doing as much for me as I'm doing for them." With the help of her adult son, Vanderloop found a way to get donated climbing rope from a gym in Golden that the men could then use to create eco-friendly dog leashes. For Bolivar, one of the many jobs he held in Venezuela was that of a dog catcher. "Vanderloop gave us the vision, and I thought that it was a good idea because I do know a little bit more about animals," Bolivar said. "She has really encouraged us to move forward. At first, everything was difficult, and she has made it so that our reality is totally different." Joking that the three of them are fluent in Google Translate, Vanderloop has managed to use her minimal Spanish skills to help the men run their booth at Stanley Marketplace. She has even managed to partner with Sloan's Lake Leroy's Bagels in selling some of their leashes during the day. "Our goal is to get me out of the middle and to have this be their business," Vanderloop said. "For us, this opportunity is very important because you leave your country with the hope of a better life, of a total change," Bolivar said. "I am truly sure that most of us come with the plan to work, and that is why we are 100% grateful for this valuable opportunity." The marketplace concept is much like other storefront units in Stanley. Visitors are able to peruse through the food, goods, and services on display. A rotation of almost 30 different vendors over the last 3 weeks have filled the space, including some who have since moved their services out working as personal contractors. Organizers have also built a submission form for other migrant vendors potentially interested in selling goods or services at the storefront. The market was born when members of the Central Park and Park Hill Venezuelan Migrant Support Facebook group had an idea to showcase the skills of the many migrants they were supporting. All of us kind of had that same mindset of like, how can we get these people in front of an audience to make money on a consistent basis that's more sustainable, said Janessa Lockhart, an admin and volunteer with the Facebook group. Lockhart, a vendor at local farmers markets in the summer, thought of hosting a pop-up of sorts at a nearby public park. But when volunteers reached out about using one of these vacant storefronts, Stanley Marketplace General Manager Ali Fredin loved the partnership. "We have this space, and we go, we're learning these stories. We can either just ignore that or say, let's be part of the solution," Fredin said. "We've said yes to a few school-baked sales around. This is kind of no different than somebody that's made something and wants to share it. And these are all donation-based as well." Stanley offered to host the migrant market for a singular day in December, but according to Lockhart, halfway through the day it was going so well that Stanley offered us to do a series. "We are not taking anything," Fredin said. "We're not charging a usage or rental fee or percentage of sales. Everything that they are making is going to them." Migrants need to make money, and setting up inside of a marketplace with plenty of consumer foot traffic is prime real estate for this effort. Lockhart met Daniela Perez at a nearby shelter. When Perez and her family moved into their own place, Perez invited Lockhart over for arepas. Since then, Lockhart has partnered with Perez to get her business off the ground, providing transportation to and from the market, and even helping Perez and her husband create an LLC of their own. Moving forward, I would like to buy my own food truck and be able to sell my arepas whenever people would like, Perez said. Raymer Blanco caught the bus in the early morning with a plastic bin of rice pudding cups. Using aluminum foil to cover the bin, a missing lid would not keep her from making it another Tuesday. Next week, if God allows, I'll bring lasagna, Blanco says. Thanks to this program that has provided help to migrants, we are making ourselves known. Perez most recently thought of selling drinks, something that surprised Lockhart. She's been able to see the entrepreneurial spirit take among many of the migrants that return to sell in the market. So many transactions can happen without having to know the language, Lockhart said. It surprised me how quickly, especially the return vendors, are just like catching on. Due to some licensing requirements, some services like haircuts, manicures, and pedicures have become unavailable on site. The pivot for organizers and vendors is then to encourage migrants to market their services instead. According to organizers, some migrants have been able to book enough appointments to rotate out of the marketplace and operate on their own accord. The market is now open Tuesdays from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. This was because after a successful trial period, vendors are hoping to catch more visitors during the busier food traffic hours. Child care and transportation are the main challenges for organizers and vendors alike. Staggering shifts so migrants can take care of their kids and coordinating rides to and from the market are what makes this a labor-intensive role for volunteers like Lockhart. I will say it's like a giant labor of love, Lockhart said. Stanley currently has the marketplace slated to run through the end of January, but, according to Fredine, there's a possibility that the operation will continue, keeping in mind that the vacant unit could still get offers from an interested renter. And so, as long as we have a space available, we would love to keep doing it, Fredine said. The following articles are from Westward. Developer's wet dream could be resident's worst nightmare. Closing the Dark Horse by Katie Cheshire. A plan to turn the parking lot at 2952 Baseline Road off U.S. Highway 36 in Boulder into a mixed-use development has people worried about affordability, neighborhood character, and the potential closure of the legendary Dark Horse Bar and Grill, a fixture on the property for 5 decades. The Boulder Planning Board held a public hearing on the concept plan for the project on January 16th, and the public showed up, providing hours of statements about their desire to preserve the Dark Horse, among other issues. Lifelong Boulder resident Anna Malara Whitman said she's seen the destruction of Boulder's cultural hallmarks over the years and doesn't want this development to lead to the loss of another. It is one of the last remaining things in Boulder that makes me feel like it's how it was when I was growing up, Malara Whitman said. The Dark Horse is marking its 50th anniversary this year. Through the decades, its rooms have become packed with colorful memorabilia. Generations of fans from all walks of life have gathered there to watch Colorado sports teams kick back by the fire when it's cold and watch out for the tricky bathroom doors. In addition to the Dark Horse, the site currently holds a Sprouts grocery store, Corelli's Ristorante Italiano, Café Mexicali, a Cosmos Pizza, and the Boulder Broker Inn. The developers want to put in student housing and other residential buildings, 75,000 square feet of retail space, spots for restaurants, and a new hotel. The land is owned by the Williams family, who donated money to the University of Colorado to help build Williams Village on the school's campus. The site would be known as Williams Village 2. It's currently zoned under Business Community 2 and has a community business designation in the Boulder Comprehensive Plan. In general, that zoning indicates an area with predominantly neighborhood-serving retail and personal service businesses. The only building currently on the site that would remain is a McDonald's, as it is not part of the parcel controlled by the Williams family. The developers have opted to pay cash in lieu of including affordable housing in the plan. The city will use those funds to build affordable housing elsewhere. One thing to note is that we have thousands of students walking through the site every day, Bill Holicky of Coburn, the architect and planning firm on the project, told the board. That is an energy that's hard to find, and it's pretty cool. If we can use it to make a really functioning neighborhood, that'd be great. But right now, they're either walking through a parking lot or across 36. It's not a very pleasant experience. According to Holicky, the goal of the development is to make the space better for walkers and bikers and to beautify what is currently mostly asphalt. The developers are proposing phased construction that would first tackle the housing projects, including those with ground floor retail space, then move to the rest of the site's retail elements, including the dark horse. "I'll talk about the elephant, or the dark horse, in the room," said Andy Bush of Morgan Creek Ventures, a real estate development firm working on the project. "We have a memorandum of understanding that really talks about the fact that this is a 40-year relationship, and it's been a collaborative one. The Williams family has done more to save the dark horse in the last 15 or 20 years of any group, and they're still excited about trying to do that." Bush went on to say that in recent years, the family has given the bar rent discounts as it has struggled with generating business. The developers, he explained, have been looking for a way to downsize the dark horse and move it to a new building on the project site. Bush reiterated many times over the evening that the bar's owners are aging and aren't sure how long they want to keep it open, regardless of the development. Those owners could not be reached for comment, and employees working at the bar said they have no position on the development. The public, however, had plenty to say, mostly focused on affordability and the dark horse, which many at the meeting said they usually find quite full. "How many places do you know in Boulder where you can get a burger and a beer for less than $10? Answered Guillaume Lostick, a research assistant at CU. "Please keep this place alive. Please keep it affordable." Many others agreed, adding that while Boulder has catered more and more to wealthier people, the dark horse is still accessible to everyone. Commenter Ben Herman reminded the board of other developments, like the Academy Boulder Retirement Community, where retail space or affordable housing was included in a later phase and then canceled because of cost overruns. "Developers promise concessions, but rarely deliver them," Herman said. "We stand to lose all of the restaurant space in a crucial junction in town if we let the plan proceed as it is." He suggested that one of the student housing buildings be made smaller to preserve the dark horse building, and also commended the developers for certain elements of the plan, such as the two planned residential buildings with retail on the ground floor. "Initially, I was here to just talk about the dark horse and wanted to save the dark horse because I have so many amazing memories there. But after seeing this plan, I have some serious concerns in other areas," testified Boulder resident Matthew Jensen. "If you think that an adjunct professor is going to live there, I think you're out of your mind. I think the people that are going to end up living there are rich kids that their parents from California or Texas buy them properties." Others agreed, sharing current rents at Williams-owned developments to cast doubt on the affordability of the housing being built. Mark McIntyre, one of the planning board members, asked the developers if an adjunct professor at CU would be able to afford living in the market-rate units. Holicky said he didn't know how much adjuncts make, but that the goal is to get a broad range of people to live there. "The idea is that there's a strata, and that folks who have varying income economic backgrounds would be able to live there," he said. "The obvious market is CU employees, and that has been discussed a lot, so the intent would be to get CU employees in there, but it would not be accurate to say that's 100% of the market rate units." Resident Ken Farmer, who lives nearby, said he's worried that the retail spaces could also be mainly high-end boutiques, rather than stores that could help people. Other residents, including Lois LaCroix, who helped decorate the Dark Horse, pointed out that the development doesn't fit with the community business zoning the area falls under. What we've repeatedly experienced is developers coming in, identifying BC2 permitted and zoned land, and trying to get abatements to develop it in other ways, Brent Fontana said. We would simply like to see those parcels developed as intended for the use of the residents. I don't think anyone's opposed to the development. People understand the need for more housing. People understand the need for future development. But there simply doesn't seem to be any attempt by developers to actually develop the sites as zoned. Several residents were concerned with the Sprouts going away, even for a time, because there aren't other grocery stores nearby. The developers stated that Sprouts may have to close for 2 years during construction. People who live in the area also expressed concerns over noise. The discussion wasn't all negative, however. A few people spoke in favor of the development because it would eliminate an unactivated parking lot. Most comments submitted online before the hearing were in favor of the plan, noted Chandler Van Schock, principal planner with the City of Boulder. The board members asked questions and gave feedback on technical aspects of the plan, such as access roads, proper open space, building height, and parking allotments. City staff had recommended considering making the development smaller in scale, and board members seemed to agree. This isn't human-scaled, at least not as it is, said board chair Sarah Silver. Please do what you can to put humans back into the overall design. Board members said that they don't have any say whether the Dark Horse building is eligible for landmark designation, though it is old enough, having been built in 1974. And even if the building were preserved, that doesn't mean the business inside would be, they acknowledged. Some board members encouraged the developers to have a more concrete solution in the final text of the plan. The applicants will now take the feedback from the planning board and incorporate it into their proposal. Residents hope their time sitting through a very long public hearing has an impact on the plan. Aside from being the only bar in Boulder worth a damn, the Dark Horse has been a cornerstone of the city for decades and is one of the few remaining icons reminding the city of its original draw of creativity and community, said resident Aiden Young Scudis. The fact is, the Dark Horse does more for the community and student population of Boulder than exploitive student housing ever could. Last weekend's Arctic Blast will fuel higher Excel bills, by Katie Cheshire. The Arctic Blast that swept through Denver over the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend had many furnaces and boilers working overtime as temperatures dropped below zero. Though most households' pipes are out of danger and the roads and sidewalks have nearly returned to normal, one impact of the cold is still lying in wait, Xcel energy bills. After last year's record-high bills fueled by the rising cost of natural gas, people could get hit with big bills again this year thanks to the dropping temperatures. But according to Xcel, the swing won't be as drastic as last winter's because the wholesale price of natural gas isn't as high. The impact of higher natural gas prices this past weekend on the average customer natural gas bill is anticipated to be roughly $15, spread over 12 months, or roughly $1.25 per month to minimize bill impacts, the utility says through a spokesperson. For residential customers, specifically, Xcel anticipates the impact will be even lower, totaling just $1 over 3 months. However, bills could still balloon based on customer usage. When it's colder and people use more heat, their bills inevitably rise no matter the price of natural gas. In fact, on January 12th, Xcel sent an email to customers warning them of rising natural gas prices, while also reminding them that turning down thermostats is the most effective way to curb costs. While wholesale natural gas price increases primarily affect the bills of natural gas customers, we also purchase natural gas to generate electricity, so you may see some savings by conserving electricity for the next few days, Xcel noted in the email. Xcel doesn't make any additional profit when natural gas prices rise, It passes the actual commodity price of gas on to customers on their bills. Every 3 months, the company submits commodity cost adjustments based on how much it spent on natural gas to the Colorado Public Utilities Commission, which regulates investor-owned utilities in the state. While Colorado moves out of the deep freeze, we know customers are anticipating their next energy bill, which may reflect increased energy and heating use, Xcel adds. The largest portion of customer bills in the winter heating season is due to the wholesale price of natural gas, which is determined by global supply and demand, and how much customers use for heat in cold weather. Residential customers currently pay $0.3172 per therm of natural gas used under gas rate adjustments approved by the PUC in 2022. They pay an additional $0.4255 per therm from January to March to account for the commodity price of natural gas over the previous few months. Because the average resident uses 106.3 therms per month, Xcel estimates the average monthly gas bill will be $100.02. That is about $40 lower than the average residential gas bill of $139.13 per month from January to March of 2023. For small businesses, the average bill is anticipated to be $429.46 per month for the first 3 months of 2024, compared to $615.91 last year. Natural gas is also used as fuel to generate electricity at natural gas plants, which affects electric rates in addition to natural gas rates, the utility explains, so Xcel's electricity customers could feel impacts too. Using a diverse energy mix that includes renewable resources helps minimize the effect of natural gas prices, the company suggests. Xcel also attempts to protect against market fluctuations by purchasing natural gas when it's less expensive and saving it for the cold season, as well as purchasing financial hedges, which act like insurance to protect our customers from season-long wholesale price changes, according to the utility. But the best-laid plans can always be foiled by Mother Nature. On January 18th, another cold front was already moving in. The snow was great at Winter Park, and then skiers tried to get home, by Katie Cheshire. The cold snap and snow Colorado experienced over the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend canceled flights, burst pipes, and shut down schools in Metro Denver. And even though skiers enjoyed plenty of fresh powder at Winter Park, things weren't exactly a picnic when it came time to leave Denver's own mountain resort. "We've stacked up another 19 inches since yesterday morning," Winter Park Resort posted on Facebook on January 15th. "We're excited for the snow, but be sure to check cotrip.org if you are traveling today. Traction laws and road closures are in place, including Berthoud Pass." But even those who heeded that second sentence got stuck in the parking lot that Colorado's roads became on January 16th, as hordes of skiers and snowboarders tried to make it home to Denver. That was the case for Barbara McFarlane and Pete Marzik. It usually takes an hour and 20 minutes to get to their Denver home from Winter Park, the ski area they frequent. Today, that drive will take at least five times as long. The couple drove to Winter Park on January 12th to ski with their son on his birthday and got stuck there an extra day when Berthoud Pass, which is on U.S. Highway 40 between Winter Park and Denver, closed January 14th after an avalanche buried 10 cars. There were no casualties, but cleanup is taking a long time. Berthoud is still not open, so all of us who need to get back to Denver are here on the road, McFarlane says. She and her family took the recommended detour to Kremlin and then Silverthorne before getting completely stuck in an hours-long jam of other travelers heading for Interstate 70 midday on January 16th. According to Elise Thatcher, a communications manager with the Colorado Department of Transportation, the state had crews working around the clock to make Berthoud Pass safe for travel again, pulling resources from everywhere it can. "That closure has continued because of avalanche danger," Thatcher says. In other parts of US 40 and other roadways, we have longer chutes or avalanche paths above the roadways. Progress was difficult not only because of the tricky structure of the chutes, but by the inch of snow falling every hour. As CDOT crews cleared the roads and triggered many avalanches to clear off the top of the slope, they also had to contend with fresh snowfall. At first, when people heard that Berthoud Pass was closed, they embraced the chance to stick around and ski more rather than brave the much longer alternate route back to Denver. "We are living up to our name this weekend," Winter Park and Fraser Chamber, Colorado wrote on Facebook. Winter Park is expecting heavy snow to redevelop tonight and continue through Monday. Bundle up, get cozy in our local businesses, and stay safe. Patrons took the advice to heart, with giant lift lines most of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. The weather was also a culprit there, according to Jen Miller, spokesperson for Winter Park. "We had to put several of our upper lifts, Panoramic Express Lift, the Wild Spur Express, the Olympia Express, Sunnyside Express, on hold because of high winds and extreme temperatures," she says. "That meant that fewer lifts were operational to move guests up and around the mountain. Winter Park has received 62 inches of snow since January 1st, with 47 inches coming in the last 7 days. It was a big storm, even for us, and it had operational impacts." It had impacts on the skiers, too. "I've never seen lines like that, and we've been skiing Winter Park for years and years and years," McFarlane says. "They were winding their way up the mountain. The snow was good, but it took a lot of patience." And patience is required for those who couldn't stay yet another day, and finally succumbed to the drive back to reality today. "We're all in this together," McFarlane says. "Every other car here is built for the mountains, with rocket boxes on the top, skis on the top. I pity any poor local that went out for a case of eggs and is now taking them 6 hours to get home." McFarlane and Marzik had friends who had to leave Monday and reported that it took them 3 hours to get to Kremling and then another 3 hours to get to Denver, so they were prepared for a delay. Also, McFarlane notes, the roads are still icy, so it's not just traffic making progress slow. And they knew how to get back home, unlike some people they encountered on the slopes who tried to use Google and Apple Maps to find backup routes. One person was asking her phone for directions, McFarlane says. It sent her up through Wyoming to Laramie. The Kremling route is usually the fallback when Berthoud Pass is closed. Hatcher advises using CO Trip to pick the best alternative. What's really important to keep in mind is not to try and use Google Maps or Apple Maps, because if those send you onto a country road or some other roadway that's not a state roadway, there's no guarantee that road is open or that it's safe for travel, especially during a heavy winter storm, Thatcher says. This past weekend, there was another alternative, the train. But even those who took the Winter Park Express train, operated by Amtrak, had a difficult time getting home yesterday. The January 15th return trip that normally arrives by around 6:30 didn't pull into Union Station until around 2:30 a.m. in the morning of January 16th because of a stuck rail plow, among other catastrophes. Amtrak has not yet responded to Westward's queries. Before the weekend, Winter Park and Fraser Chamber, Colorado, took to Facebook to encourage people to take Amtrak to both decrease traffic and reduce the resort's carbon footprint. The booster group wasn't alone. Governor Jared Polis had ridden the train on its inaugural 2024 journey to Winter Park just 2 days before, on January 12th. The Winter Park Express train is a great service for Coloradans and the millions of visitors who come to Colorado to enjoy our world-class skiing, snowboarding, and winter activities, he wrote on X. I encourage everyone to ditch the drive this season and ride passenger rail. Polis has also been touting the possibility of more passenger rail through Colorado, including up to Steamboat. The feds recently awarded the state funds to explore that route. In the meantime, the Winter Park Express train will be making runs to the resort Friday through Sunday through March 31st. It also runs on two holidays, the first of which was January 15th. And despite the very delayed return trip on MLK Day, Skiers just might want to take their chances on the train next weekend, since the Colorado Avalanche Information Center has extended its warning for the area until 3:30 p.m. Thursday. An avalanche warning is in effect for the Front Range, Summit County, and Northern Sawatch Range, the agency notes. Very dangerous avalanche conditions continue after the storm. You can easily trigger avalanches large enough to bury you. But as of late Wednesday, January 17th, Berthoud Pass is open. Our crews have been out doing everything they can to keep the roads open as much as possible. But there are times when the roads need to be closed due to conditions or avalanche danger, Thatcher says. We certainly empathize with those who are waiting for roads to reopen. Denver's Queen of Quips, Georgia Comstock, talks life, laughs, and the art of stand-up, by Tony Tresca. I just feel like life is my biggest influence, says Denver-based comedian Georgia Comstock. You've got to keep laughing, or otherwise you're going to be crying. In a field where humor is a currency, Comstock is striking it rich. Originally from Omaha, she's been a comic for more than a decade and recently secured a coveted recurring spot at Denver's Comedy Works. Her rise to prominence is highlighted by appearances at such prestigious festivals as the High Plains Comedy Fest and Limestone, demonstrating the power of a punchline and the allure of an authentic voice. I began headlining Comedy Works in September, and having that much time on stage in front of supportive audiences, with people coming out specifically to see me, is an incredible experience, especially for a local comedian, she says. During the day, I have a regular life, and I'm always trying to better myself as a person, Comstock adds. I feel like a lot of my material comes from my life and family. I'm married, so I make jokes about my in-laws and stuff like that. Being in my 30s, I like to look back at my early 20s and be like, oh my God, what was I doing? Those days were back when Comstock's foray into comedy began. It was 2013, and she recalls she wasn't sure what she was doing and feeling lost. I was working a day job and taking some improv classes for fun, Comstock recalls. I did that for about a year before deciding to try stand-up on my own. I was having fun doing it, but at that age, you wonder, is this what I'm going to do long-term? I had no idea, but it just kept being fun, and I kept getting better and booking bigger and bigger things. Denver, she discovered, was the perfect playground for her comedic ambitions. Comstock moved here in 2015 with her husband, Nick Dean, a fellow comedian. She came here because she had heard great things about the city, especially Comedy Works, and she fell in love with Denver right away. The area has served as a nurturing ground for Comstock to develop new material in front of encouraging audiences. I feel like I just stumbled into this amazing thing, Comstock says of the local scene. I'm 32 now, and I was 21, right on the cusp of turning 22, when I started. I just celebrated 10 years of comedy last September, so being able to headline my hometown club is a huge deal. People do cool things out here, but never make it to that point, so it was a cool milestone. There are not many tangible milestones in comedy, so this felt fantastic. Comstock is particularly grateful to Comedy Works for believing in her and giving her so much stage time. Comedy Works is one of the best clubs in the country, she says. The downtown club is legendary, and I've been super fortunate to be able to work with such cool people and do such cool shows. Denver comics are good, so a lot of people say we keep them on their toes. We're also always doing new stuff and being weird. It's just the best stage to be able to frequent and grow as a comic, because Denver has truly incredible audiences. Over those years, Comstock has also witnessed firsthand the evolution of comedy in the age of social media. She believes that the internet has democratized the industry and made it easier for fans of specific styles to discover comics that interest them. On the internet, you can be a niche comic and do a style that you like, Comstock explains. Comedy is so readily available now. There used to be a path you would take. people would say, you have to do these sets to get late night so you can get represented and blah, blah, blah. And now you can put stuff out on your own and create your audience. You can still take other paths, but there are so many paths now. And just because something worked for somebody else doesn't mean it's going to work again. It's just interesting how many shapes it can take now. And you just never know what's going to be popular and what people are going to latch on to. Back in the day, the people who made it had been doing it for 15 to 20 years, she continues. Now you have people who have been doing it for about 2 to 3 years saying, I guess I have to do an hour now. With social media constantly evolving, I believe comedy will continue to change. And Comstock is a comic who practices what she preaches. Her upcoming show at Comedy Works South on Wednesday, January 24th, promises a mix of old favorites and fresh material. I've been working on a new chunk of my set that I'm pretty excited about, she explains. I mentioned it briefly in my show on January 3rd, but I'm bringing back an old story that was simply too long to fit into a 15 to 20 minute set, because it would have taken up the majority of it. I'm excited to bring that out and experiment with new topics that I'm passionate about. Comstock's 2024 is bustling with even more exciting projects. In addition to her regular sets, she's looking forward to the new show Catfish Comedy at Comedy Works. It's a fun, weird time, she says, inviting audiences to experience the unique format. The show features comedians performing stand-up routines based on suggestions from the audience. And because performers are not announced ahead of time, you never know who might show up at Catfish Comedy. Upcoming shows are scheduled for Thursday, January 18th at Comedy Works Downtown and February 16th and 17th at Comedy Works South. While Comstock is excited about the future, she's also using the new year to reflect on the opportunities she's had over the last few years. I'm always growing and looking for that next thing, but I'm also taking the time to honor a lot of great achievements, she concludes. I have some cool dates coming up this year. I'll be back on the road with Dusty Slay for a few days in about a month, and I'm doing a lot of cool stuff with Comedy Works. I'm trying to soak up those accomplishments so I can enjoy them before moving forward. Georgia Comstock, Wednesday, January 24th, Comedy Works South, 5345 Landmark Place, Greenwood Village. Tickets are available at comedyworks.com. Adaptive pro skier Trevor Kinnison comes full circle in new documentary by Abigail Bliss. I've always wanted to lead by example, says Trevor Kinnison, a professional adaptive skier based in Winter Park. He quickly rose to fame in 2019 after airing into Corbeil's Couillard, a legendary 45-degree pitch at Jackson Hole Mountain Resort named after legendary ski instructor and mountain guide Gary Corbeil. Like Corbeil, Kinnison learned how to live and thrive with spinal cord injuries, SCI, and the experiences of both athletes are highlighted in the documentary Full Circle, now showing in select theaters and coming to Netflix on January 19th. A lifelong athlete, Kinnison was born and raised in Keene, New Hampshire, where his parents owned a snowboard shop. He learned to ride at a young age, but took a long hiatus from snowboarding, favoring soccer, volleyball, and junior Olympic swimming. Kinnison experienced several sports-related injuries while young, however, and was first prescribed painkillers during his freshman year of high school. He developed a serious addiction that affected his everyday abilities and lasted for 6 years. Ultimately, he overcame his dependence on pills, became a skilled plumber, and moved to Colorado. He arrived in Avon on November 9, 2013, and quickly got back into snowboarding, spending around 65 days on the slopes that first season while working a full-time job. Almost exactly a year later, on November 15, 2014, Kinnison suffered a paralyzing snowboarding accident at Vail Pass while attempting a 40-foot jump, something that, to him, was neither new nor extreme. He shattered his T11 and T12 vertebrae, punctured his spinal cord, and dislocated his back 90 degrees into his stomach. Right away, he knew he was paralyzed. I was 2 years clean when I broke my back, and I just remember lying on the snow on Vail Pass thinking, oh shit, I have to get back on pain pills, recalls Kinnison. It took over 3 hours for the search and rescue team to reach him through a blizzard, and as he waited, he thought about his family, his then-girlfriend, his career, and even the possibility that he might not survive. Life in a wheelchair didn't cross his mind. At Craig Hospital in Inglewood, Kinnison excelled in rehab. But despite his physical achievements and generally positive attitude, adjusting to his new version of life wasn't easy. Corbet had gone through similar challenges after surviving a helicopter crash near Aspen in 1968 that left him paralyzed from the waist down. He, too, received treatment at Craig. Full Circle features an interview with Craig psychologist Dr. Lester Butt. There are people that come into the facility that truly feel their lives are over, he notes in the film. Fortunately, both Corbet and Kinnison refuse to let their passion for life be limited by their injuries, either physically or mentally. In his book, Options: Spinal Cord Injury and the Future, published in 1980, Corbet reminded SCI survivors, "You have not been deprived of choice." Before his accident, Corbet was a member of the first U.S. team to summit Mount Everest, made first ascents up Antarctica's two highest peaks, and established several new routes in the Teton Range, among other mountaineering accomplishments. He was also a filmmaker who produced several titles, including Ski the Outer Limits. Following his injury, Corbet went through periods of solitude and depression, but he found fulfillment when he returned to the outdoors. He continued to push physical boundaries and became a skilled kayaker, a sport few paralegics dared to try in 1976. He continued making adventure films along with Changes, a documentary about wheelchair users. His advocacy for the disabled community was amplified when, in 1991, he became the editor of New Mobility, a magazine that covers the lives and achievements of people with SCI. Josh Berman, who directed Full Circle, saw the similarities in Corbet's and Kinnison's experiences. It really turned the whole concept of the project upside down and opened the story to a new perspective, he says. I ultimately feel like we made a better film combining their stories. As Full Circle points out, Kinnison isn't just an adaptive athlete. He's an athlete in the greatest sense. He's an Eddie Bauer community leader, sponsored by GoPro, Icon Pass, and other entities. According to Outside Magazine, he's one of the most influential people in the outdoor industry. The documentary highlights several of his professional triumphs, winning the Writer's Choice Award at the invite-only Kings and Queens of Corbet's, launching off the X Games Big Air Jump, and finding redemption at Vail Pass, where he completed a double backflip on a sit ski 6 years after his injury. The film also covers other areas where Kinnison has had to adapt, from navigating relationships and completing basic biological functions to simply accepting his new different reality. You see my physical wheelchair, but everything is so internal, he notes. It's so mental, this whole battle, you know? Longmont set to get its first food haul in May, by Molly Martin. While the food haul boom has started to wane in Denver, they've continued to pop up outside of Colorado's capital city. The warehouse debuted in Craig in 2021. The following year brought Bluebird Market to Silverthorne, Morris and May to Golden, and Freedom Street Social to Arvada. Last year, Fuel and Iron took the food haul trend to Pueblo. Now it's Longmont's turn. One of our favorite unexpected dining destinations is set to get its first food hall in May. The 16,000-square-foot Parkway Food Hall will be located in the Parkway Promenade Shopping Center at 700 Ken Pratt Boulevard. It will include three retail spaces, an indoor-outdoor bar, a patio and event space, and room for eight dining concepts. The principal architect on the project, Meridian 105, also designed Avanti Food and Beverage and Edgewater Public Market. The operating partner is National Food Hall Solutions, which opened Junction Food and Drink on South Colorado Boulevard in 2020. Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News. My name is Dave Dell.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.